Is there a new season of The Bear?
What?
Is there a new season of The Bear? Is there? Did I see that?
No.
Let me check.
There can't be. I would have heard about that.
Season 3.
Is this our cold open?
not if you keep asking if it's the cold open. Oh. Whoa, seasons 3 and 4 are being filmed back to back.
Oh, crazy.
Okay, no, it's not out yet. Sorry. I don't know why I thought that.
It's probably not going to be out for a year if they're filming 2 seasons back to back.
Okay, never mind.
Fair enough. I mean, I got excited there for a second. Did you hear that somewhere? Or?
I think.
Did you just wake up this morning? You had a dream last night where you were watching a new episode of The Bear and you're like,
I think maybe on some streaming thing it said season 3 of The Bear, but then it meant like coming soon or something. But I don't know.
Coming not so soon.
Yeah.
Alan, if you're looking for food content, food shows to watch, you should check out some anime.
Oh yeah, you know what? Okay, what are you talking about? Which shows specifically?
Okay, so specifically what I've been watching like lately that's related to food, anime wise, is Delicious in Dungeon, which is a show on Netflix that's like a Dungeons and Dragons adventure party anime where they are delving into a dungeon. There's this like party of characters and they're cooking these like amazing dishes using parts from monsters that they are dispatching.
Okay.
Which is like a taboo practice that everyone thinks is like really weird and gross. But there's this like dwarf who has been living in the dungeon and understands the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And it's like really in depth. It's hilarious. Like it's really good.
Delicious in Dungeons.
Delicious in Dungeon. Yeah.
Oh, in Dungeon. Okay.
And then I know that there's an anime out there because I've seen clips of it, like the famous croissant clip. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Okay, well, there's this clip that went around social media a few years ago, and it's like this person, it's like a baking class. Mm-hmm. So there is an anime out there that's like about a cooking school or something like that, which I don't know the title of it off the top of my head, and so I probably shouldn't have brought it up, but I'll put some information about it in the show notes because I kind of want to check it out too. But there's a clip from it where they have to bake croissants and there's this like, you know, the teacher's describing what the ultimate croissant would be and what technique you have to reproduce to be able to make like this like super croissant. And everyone bakes their croissants and they all like look okay, but some of them are kind of dry and flaky. And then there's this one student who bakes a croissant and it's like black on the outside, like it's completely burnt. And the teacher comes by to inspect it and taps it with a spoon, and all of the like black, all the black crust on the outside like crumbles away, like falls away in this like very dramatic fashion. And the croissant inside is like glowing gold, and then it just like explodes into like shining croissant light everywhere.
Okay. Well, so why was it black on the outside?
I don't know. It's just like part of the drama. I guess that's how you have to bake it to make it, you know, like forms a crust on the outside or something. I don't know. I don't think it's very realistic, but seals in all the buttery moisture. I do. Yeah. Good question, Alan.
There was several years ago now, someone recommended an anime cooking show to me and can't remember the name, but I did watch one clip of it and was shocked at how inventive and yet plausible the food that was in this scene was.
Right.
So yeah, maybe it is worth looking into.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me know if you remember the name of that one. And then also like, I will look up the name of the one that the croissant clip is from. And also I do recommend Delicious in Dungeon for the same reason. Like most of the food that they cook is like based on relatively mundane dishes, but the attention to detail and like what, you know, the things that they, you know, the things that are represented in the dish and the way the recipes are represented and stuff is like shockingly like real and the cooking techniques and stuff and and the circumstances under which they have to cook are kind of challenging. And so, like, you know, there's a scene where someone has to build and maintain a fire and they have very limited resources and they like the, you know, they it's it feels real. It's right. Pretty funny.
Cool.
Delicious in Dungeon. It's like rolling out weekly right now. I think I'm like an episode behind or something. I don't know. Maybe we leak. Maybe we need a separate podcast for talking about anime cooking shows. I don't know.
Great.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sutterby. How are you doing, Alan?
Great.
We are two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. Got it in one.
It's funny, before we started this recording, you're like, Alan, how are you? And I was like, oh, I'm tired. I'm really run down right now. And then when we're doing our chirpy... happy intro. I'm like, oh, I'm great. Don't worry about it.
Well, when I suggested that we do another podcast about anime, you were like, so I think it's, I think we can feel it. Been a busy few weeks for you, hey?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's kind of what we're going to talk about, so that's fun. Before we get into it, do we have any follow-up?
I had a couple quick follow-up pieces, I think.
Okay.
One, I just wanted to mention, so our last conversation, which feels like a lifetime ago, Shale.
Oh, my God.
On the movie Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. I found a really good, I guess, video essay on YouTube by a channel called Accented Cinema, and it's about the movie, and it's, I think the video is called Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, What is a Chinese Family? And it's pretty short and straightforward, but it was a really good video for me because it was able to provide a lot more insight and explanation of Chinese traditions, expectations, values, and like some of the nuances of the culture that I really didn't know anything about. So I would recommend it. If you like the movie Eat, Drink, Man, Woman and want a little bit more context or background or explanation, it's a good one.
Yeah. Or need a little bit more like we obviously did, but probably some people understand the culture a lot better than we did.
Right.
Yeah, I watched it as well. And yeah, I would say that, I mean, it's a sort of a personal essay, but from someone who understands the Taiwanese culture. So it's,
I enjoy
it's their own personal interpretation of what the cultural parts of the movie are, for sure. But, you know, someone with definitely more insight into the culture than I have. So yeah, that was enlightening.
Able to shed light on the family values, but also on the American influence. We kind of mentioned, but didn't really
understand maybe the breadth of the thematic weight there or something.
Like there were some things shown in the movie where I took for granted, like they seemed familiar to me and I took it for granted. But then in this video essay, they pointed out like, this is an American thing. Like this is one of the American influences that are showing up increasingly in their lives in Taiwan. Do you know what I mean? So like they recognized it as foreign influence, but for me, it was just,
familiarity, something that probably, made the movie
think it
feel
was something
more familiar.
Like for example, like there was a scene of a wedding, there were elements of the wedding that was happening at the banquet hall that were Western that this person was able to point out and say, see, like this is not a traditional Chinese element of a wedding. It's part of the American influence that this movie is commenting on, but
right.
Anyways, yeah. And the other thing...
I will also put a link to that in the show notes.
Okay, cool. for follow-up, the conversation before Eat, Drink, Man, Woman was about Seafood City. And I just wanted to say that I've gone back a couple times since that conversation. It bothered me.
Wow.
We got to a point, we were talking about the Grill City counter at Seafood City. And I was like, oh, I think the only thing I've eaten there is chicken in a sal. Mm-hmm. So I went back and I got a nice little spread, a nice little smorg of a, I probably tried five more things or something, but
great.
I had baguette, which is deep fried pork belly, which was delicious. Mm. Great crackling. And I had the pork skewers. They're wonderful. I think they're made of shoulder. And they're just like dunked in a bath of this sweet glaze sauce before they're served to you. And I had liempo, which is grilled pork belly. Pretty tasty. It's like, it kind of flares up on the grill. And so it's like got a kind of ashen.
Yeah, it's like got a bunch of char on it, which is like, you know, I mean, I think maybe culturally here, that's something that people when they're cooking try to avoid. Mm-hmm. But it's like clearly an integral part of that liempo preparation.
Totally.
And I really enjoyed it. But yeah.
Yeah, same.
It's different, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it is nice, like in my mind, pork belly is like a low and slow, like it's got to be braised right. or slowly smoked or whatever until like it's completely, the connective tissue is totally broken down and it's like soft mm-hmm. and yielding. But that's not how they do. Well, the baguette was kind of like that, but the liempo definitely has a little bit more chew than we would expect.
Yeah, it's really usually, chewy. It's not like, it's marinated obviously for a long time in something to sort of tenderize it a little bit, but it's just cooked quickly on the grill. It reminds me, like texturally, it reminds me of something like bulgogi short ribs or something like that, you know?
Totally. Yeah.
Like where it's like a, it's a tougher cut. It's a piece of working muscle and it's like cooked quickly, but it's marinated a lot ahead of time to sort of, you know, give it a little bit of tenderness, but you still get like a really great chewy texture out of it.
Right. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of in love with that. Like, and I do think it's a little, like in Western cooking, most of those tough cuts, it's like every time it's going to be a braise, like, you know, like there's no two ways about it. If you're going to eat that meat, it's got to be soft. And I don't really agree.
So right.
It's nice. It's nice to have those things available, you know? Yeah.
And the last thing I tried at Grill City was, sisig, which is like, it's like a pork head hash, like pork. They call it the mask, but it's like the, like you
want
a bone. Yeah. Boned out. pork face.
Crazy.
It's usually boiled and then grilled and then chopped and kind of made into this hash. And the one at Seafood City is really delicious. I was talking to, I had several Filipino students in this last block at school, and they were telling me that that sisig at Seafood City is not very traditional.
Oh, really?
Because it like is in this kind of, It's very saucy. It's almost like a stew almost.
Right.
It tastes great. It's very delicious, but you have like these crispy, crispy bits of pork head that are coated in sauce. And so a lot of the texture is almost like ginger beef. Like if you can picture like, you know what I mean? Like glazed crispy meat.
Glazed crispy thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So they actually, just this past Friday for our like staff meal, or not staff meal, family meal, whatever, for the students in evening dining this past Friday, they made sisig like in their, what they said was a much more traditional way. And it
cool.
was
awesome. Did you just have a pig head laying around in the fridge or what?
We did have a pig head laying around in the fridge. You know why?
That's amazing. Let me guess.
Don't kill my segue. This is a perfect segue.
Okay,
don't go on a tangent right now.
No, I don't know why, Alan. Why did you have a pig head in the fridge?
We had a pig head in the fridge because it was an extra head from one of the services we did for Nate's 2024 chef in residence.
Oh, special ingredients.
Yeah.
Right on. And what are we going to talk about today, Alan?
Yes.
Perfect segue. 2024 Chef in Residence program.
Yeah. which was
great segue.
The chef in residence was Blair Lebsack of Range Road here in Edmonton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's exciting.
So we'd like to talk about last week and what went down, but we can also, if we've got time, we can even just talk about the chef in residence program in general, because this is the, the 14th, 15th? They've been doing it since 2009. So there's been, I think, because of the pandemic, there was a year or two missed there, but I think there've been 14 chefs in residence. Maybe if we've got time, we can talk about some of the historical ones as well.
Yeah, sounds good. Is it pretty rare that there's a chef from Edmonton who is the chef in residence?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a good question. In fact, this was the first time, not only the first time that it's been a, let me think about this for a second. It's definitely the first time it's been a chef from Edmonton. I think it's the first time that it's been a chef who graduated from Nate, because Blair graduated from, I think, the Cook Apprentice program in 2000 or 2001.
Okay.
And I believe it's, it's definitely the first time that it's actually been a former Nate instructor, because Blair taught at Nate.
Right.
Circa 2010, I think.
10 or 12 or something, maybe?
Something like that.
Yeah.
It was awesome. Like, to have someone from the city and from the program as the chef in residence was fantastic. The folks who were able to attend the events, like, kind of had buy-in because it was an Edmonton restaurant. And for the students, like, mm-hmm. to know that this is someone who went through the same kitchens as... Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was really fantastic. It was really fun.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I have never worked with Blair, but just on... sort of peripherally on a few event projects and things, mm-hmm. That where we have both been doing like maybe something separate or something. I've had a little bit of contact with Blair, like we're getting to work alongside him. Mm-hmm. He's got a pretty, I don't know his whole resume, but before he was teaching at Nate, he was, the chef at a restaurant in Edmonton, at the Union Bank Inn. The restaurant is called
Madison's Grill.
Right.
Yeah. I think he was the executive chef of the Union Bank Inn. But then, right. they're a real kind of feature. Well, yeah. They have a fine dining restaurant.
Madison's.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I would say, I don't know, maybe I'm out of touch, but I would say that probably he was the chef there during their heyday. I think there was a time when they were considered one of the best restaurants in the city.
Definitely, yeah.
And I think that was during the time that Blair was there. And I know that they did a lot of things to really try to make their menu locally focused.
Yes.
To the extent that they had beehives on the roof of the hotel, if I understand correctly. I believe so, yeah.
Cool. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Or at the very least, they were growing things up there. But yeah, that seems to be stuck in my head that they were keeping bees.
Mm-hmm.
I think and Range Road definitely has like a very local focus. Like creativity and local food are probably like kind of the focus of Range Road, which is Blair's restaurant now.
Yes. And which is,
and
probably,
they also have like a butcher shop that's connected to it, where they do a lot of like pâtés and cold preparations and
dry aged beef and stuff like that.
Dry aged beef, yeah. It's sort of a little grocery store. Like, they have some specialty product in there and stuff as well.
Yeah, so Range Road is probably it's one of the best expressions of the farm to table movement in Edmonton and probably one of the most successful, and it's consistently, mm-hmm. Like as one example, like it's consistently named one of the best three restaurants in the city by, for instance, Edify Magazine, formerly Avenue right. Magazine. I think you're right that like when I was starting, just starting out as a cook, the restaurants that I held in the highest regard, they were kind of all of a similar style. And it was Hardware Grill, Madison's Grill, Jack's Grill,
Red Ox Grill, Red Ox Inn. Red Ox Grill.
Red Ox Inn Grill, yeah.
The Blue Pear Grill.
Oh, yeah, and Blue Pear, that's right. Blue Pear was kind of cut from different cloth, but...
Yeah, different sort of restaurant.
But, oh, and Range Road is literally in the building that... Like, it's where Blue Pear was. I forgot about that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Whenever I eat there, I'm always like... It always seems very busy, and I don't really want to ask, but I have taken a quick peek in the kitchen, and it's... I mean, it's changed... For sure, from what it was like when the Blue Pear was in there, but not by enough to make the space like gigantic or anything.
Right. Yeah.
It's a pretty tight kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Should we start just maybe with generally what the Chef in Residence program is?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
So basically, since 2009, in March, a chef is invited to come and spend 1 week at Nate in the culinary arts department. And usually the structure has changed a little bit over the years, but generally what happens is they'll arrive on Monday or Tuesday and then give a kind of keynote address to the entire culinary department, like in an auditorium, just what their story is, their kind of philosophy when it comes to food. And then there might be, like they'll visit all the labs and maybe do demos or presentations and do some cooking with the students. But on Wednesday night, there's a very large reception, with food and wine, where, folks from industry and friends of Nate are brought in to taste some of, the chef in residence food. So they would be, like designing these menus and then assisting the students with the production and service.
Right.
And then there's typically a large featured lunch service on the Thursday and a special menu, again, designed by the chef in residence, on Thursday and Friday evening, of that week, at the, at Ernest, at the restaurant on the Nate campus. So yeah, it's been, do you want me to rattle off, some of the chefs who have, done this before?
Sure. And I have a question about it after you do.
Okay. I'll just blast through them. The chefs in residence starting in 2009 and going forward, we have Rob Feeney, David Agi, Susser Lee, Massimo Capra, Chris Cosentino, Lynn Crawford, Michael Statlander, Vikram Vij, Amanda Cohen, Rod Butters, David Hawksworth, Jeremy Charles. Last year it was a chef duo. It was Connie D'Souza and John Jackson, and this year Blair Lebsack. So some pretty big names. And so this program started it started the year before I was a student at Nate. So I was there when David Agi and then Susser Lee were chefs in residence. And
that's pretty crazy.
And got to actually go back. There was a couple of years where I was either invited or just kind of invited myself to attend some of the demonstrations that some of the other chefs did, like Massimo Capra and stuff. But
that's cool. And so, Chris Cosentino. I feel like I've heard you talk about Chris Cosentino as a...
I didn't meet him and I wasn't able to attend any of the things there. But yeah, that was a really big name at the time. Not that it isn't now, but especially because I think at the time he was still at Encanto, and this was a really well-known restaurant at the time. And he was, you know, competing on Iron Chef, and he was the American, is this a weird thing to say? He was the American Fergus Henderson, kind of like really.
Yeah, maybe.
In terms of, he was famous for using offcuts, right? Like that's what he was all about.
That's right.
Was nose to tail. Yeah. So yeah, I didn't get to meet him. I remember at the time or shortly there before, I was working with Chris Hyde at Jackson. He got to spend a lot of time with Chris Cosentino. And anyways, yeah. So some big big names, big characters, big a lot of them are TV personalities really. And yeah, it's really fun.
Okay, so here's my question.
Yeah.
And sincerely, I don't mean for this to sound cynical. I'm genuinely curious. Like, yeah, like you're saying, it's a lot of big names, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, like my sort of, I guess my like assumption with, you know, chefs who are kind of famous or something, is that they, and especially, you know, when they're in the middle of, you know, running a famous restaurant, is that they must be extremely busy.
Right.
And they must have, pardon the pun, a lot on their plate. Sorry. If I could have thought of something better, I would have. that's not the podcast that this is, Al. and so, you know, like I, you know, I'm just like, you know, picturing myself in their shoes, and I receive an email or a phone message or something from a cooking school in a city that I've only ever heard of because I know who Wayne Gretzky is.
Harsh.
I mean,
yeah.
Even for David Adjaye, that's probably true.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, you know, what's the incentive for chefs to take a week out of their schedule and come to Nate to do this program? I mean, like, I would love to be able to think that, you know, it's altruism and they're like, wow, I just want to give back to some Canadian students. Mm-hmm. They're so disadvantaged. They have no food culture there. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Is there like, I guess like, first of all, is there a monetary incentive for them to come and do this program? I imagine there must be. Mm-hmm. But then also, like, what's the benefit of the program to the school aside from, you know, to the students getting to be exposed to some different food and things like that? Like, what's the incentive to the school? Is there a fundraising incentive or something like that?
Okay. Well, the truth is that I can't answer a lot of those, but I, yeah,
oh,
so,
fair.
So,
yeah,
so certainly
sorry.
I'm not,
I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Oh, that's okay. Oh yeah. I don't mean because of, it's because I'm not actually involved in the organizing of it. And so definitely they are paid to be there. They're paid and right. They're put up in a hotel. And so I couldn't even guess what, how much they're paid. But yeah, it's no, definitely,
it probably differs.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then for why, well, and that kind of answers your second question. What's in it for the chefs in residence? Like, it's a great way for them to promote, well, either their restaurants or just their kind of personal brand. And it is also like it's a great bit of promotion for the program because usually, like it'll get news coverage basically, right? Like there will be stories, in local media, you know, so-and-so is visiting this week as chef in residence at Nate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it definitely like, it seems like a, and it, yeah, it's a really fun cross promotion, I think for whoever's involved. I don't know. It's hard to say like what the, you know, if someone has restaurants in Vancouver or Toronto, like what good is promoting in Edmonton. So that's
and it seems like a fairly small, like, I mean, like I know that, yeah, it gets covered in the news and stuff, but like it doesn't seem or doesn't feel to me like Nate does a whole lot to promote it outside of the school. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I mean, like for instance, the only reason why I knew that it was happening was because you mentioned it to me.
Right.
You know, I'm not constantly reading every food magazine in Edmonton or anything like that, but I am pretty plugged into the, like the food social media. And so, you know, you would think that if it was like, you know, being heavily promoted by the school or something, it would have popped up somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm trying to think, like I certainly saw my principal, like food specific, local media is, Taproot Edmonton's food roundup. Like every Tuesday, Taproot sends out really, really thorough notes on what's happening in town, like from restaurant openings and closures to events to even things that are more like agricultural kind of. But it's actually, it's exhaustive. It's a really great list. And I would recommend if anyone's interested in the Edmonton food scene, you can subscribe to it for free, but it's basically like Sharon Yao. I don't know if she still does it, but Sharon Yao used to write on her blog, Only Here for the Food. She wrote such amazing food notes every week that basically people who are writing for the journal and the Sun would just read her blog and then figure out what they need to write.
Make their stories from it.
Yeah. And Sharon Yao is like her partner, Mac Mail, is the owner, one of the owners and founders of Taproot. And so it's like a really hardcore version of the food notes that she either used to, or maybe she still does them, but it's a great mailing list.
Right. I've like seen it a few times, but I'm actually not subscribed, which is criminal. So I'll subscribe this week.
Food Court's been mentioned on it.
Yeah.
In September or something. Yeah. So
I'm a bad person, Alan. Yeah. I'm a bad person.
Anyways, so this year with Blair Lebsack, the keynote on Tuesday, it was actually Blair and also Kevin Kosowin presented, so who we've talked about quite a lot because of the From the Wild cooking classes that I've been involved with. The keynote, Blair talked about the real like origin of Range Road is these dinners that he decided to put on with a farm near Viking, Alberta called Nature's Green Acres, where the concept was literally farm to table, but like literally everything they would serve at this dinner that is going to take place in the fields of Nature's Green Acres will come from that farm. The produce, the meat, everything.
Yeah.
And so they spent, spent a year deciding what they would plant and, what animals they would raise and slaughter. And then cross their fingers and hope for good weather and then set a long table up in the field. And I distinctly remember these dinners. I never attended one personally, but Lisa did actually, my partner Lisa did. And so she has photos of the food and stuff from, it wasn't the very first one, but it was a subsequent one at Nature's Green Acres. And for the local food community, at the time, like these dinners were kind of a stir, right? Like they were
a big deal.
Widely covered in, you know, by bloggers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And
I've seen tons of photos of those dinners because it's for a couple of weeks, like in a lot of Edmonton food blogs, that's like all that would get discussed, like the lead up to it and what last year's dinner was like. And there would be some promotion for it. And and then afterwards, like the night of the dinner, like everybody that, you know, I followed who was a foodie who was invited, their, you know, whole Instagram would turn into a stream of photos from the dinner. And then, people would be talking about it. It was a big deal. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, even after Range Road opened, they were still doing that dinner for a few years.
Yeah, I think they would still make a point of doing one in the summer months. They went on to started at Nature's Green Acres, but I think they did it at several others. I think at Peas on Earth, I think they did one.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember the others, but and so that is the origin. And interestingly, Blair really started doing those when he was an instructor at Nate, because he had the instructors have the summers off, and so he had time to do these dinners, and a lot of work went into them. Like they were building cob ovens on site to, like, because they're like, how do you cook in the middle of a field? Yeah, so that's another interesting Nate connection. And then he did talk in the keynote about even though he enjoyed working at Nate and had the generous time off in the summer and everything, so he was kind of conflicted. He knew that he, at one point, his whole goal was to own his own restaurant, right? And he had a kind of entrepreneurial desire, and so he was conflicted. Like, should I leave Nate to open this restaurant? And because obviously he knows what the hours will, like how much work it will be and what the hours will be like. And, but he did decide to leave Nate and open Range Road. He talked about, it's kind of a similar story that I've heard from other chefs in residence, where the kind of two sides of the coin, where it's a lot of like to work as a chef, and especially to own your own business, obviously it's a huge amount of work, and a lot of it is not glamorous. And so he was talking, you know, it was just a few days ago, he had to clean a grease trap and that kind of thing. Yeah. But he did a really wonderful job of letting the culinary students know that like, it can be a really great career, and you'll get to see things and experience things that not many other people do in a workplace. And so, yeah, it was a nice, and he also touched on, the sustainability of working as a chef, like from a personal standpoint, like
a work-life balance standpoint.
You really can do, as long as you're finding the right places to work and as a manager, like, prioritizing this, like it is possible to find that balance in the industry. So,
possible, but difficult, which is why he would bring it up.
Yes.
You know, if it didn't need to be talked about, he probably wouldn't have talked about it, but it's, you know, like it's sort of an obvious one. You know, I think that's a question probably in a lot of, students' minds, a lot of people who are starting out a culinary career, and especially if they read a lot of, you know, books about restaurants, or, you know, watch cooking shows on television or whatever the case may be, it's usually always portrayed as something that's sort of like all consuming and,
right,
you know, where you have to give everything from, you know, like, all of your time to it or something like that. And,
right.
And yeah, I can attest to the fact that what Blair is saying is true, because in my current position, I have a job that I really enjoy, and I also have, you know, a reasonable work-life balance, and it's, you know, a totally sustainable spot for me to be in. It was hard to find.
Right.
For sure.
Yeah.
It's not every place, that's for sure. It's pretty rare, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily because, owners or managers, want to be taking advantage of their staff or things like that. It's just like the economic demands of the industry are pretty ruthless. And in order for restaurants to stay open, it often requires, you know, the type of commitment from people that preclude that type of work-life balance. And, you know, I would be shocked to find out that there wasn't a time during the, during the startup of Range Road and the first few years that Blair did not have such a sustainable work-life balance.
Right. Yeah.
It's encouraging to hear that, you know, he feels like he's found that now, but yeah, I can't imagine that in the beginning of owning that restaurant, that it wasn't a lot of, you know, a lot of long days and a lot of sleepless nights.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he gave a keynote, and it was inspiring. Did you find it inspiring, Alan? Do you want to go open a restaurant now? Or,
well, it was inspiring, but not in that way. it really, like, it was great to hear him talk, because he was, like I mentioned, I was very aware of him when I was starting out as a cook, because of Madison's Grill, and because he was at the forefront of farm to table. And did I mention this yet? He actually taught me while I was in culinary school. Did I say that?
Oh, you didn't mention that. No. Wow. That's great.
When I was, it is almost the lunchtime version of the class that I teach now. So right now, like my class cooks the dinner services at Ernest, but there's also another class that cooks for lunch. And so, Blair was the instructor. I can't remember the name. I think the course was called Dining Room Cuisine or something like that. He taught me. And so I was like over the moon to have him as an instructor, because I knew I'd eaten at Madison's and knew who he was, very aware of who he was.
Right.
It was awesome. The best part, like, yes, the keynote was good. But then I got to hang out with him a lot later in the week, because my class was involved in the production and service of so many of the menus. So yeah, it was
that's
it
great.
Was really fun.
Have you ever worked with Blair, like on events or anything like that? Did we do any events for Elm while we were working there together where Blair was involved? Or?
I have done a couple events with him. Like, for instance, Kevin Coswin organized a wild game dinner at Range Road. Like, he got a dispensation from some level of government to serve actual game that I think for that one, Blair had actually shot the deer that was served that night.
Okay.
And so they invited a bunch of chefs to come. Each chef would do a course. And I was invited and did a pappardelle with venison meatballs or something, but so stuff like that. But I've never worked for him.
Right, like at a restaurant or something.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, my recollections of like working alongside him is that he's extremely organized.
Mm-hmm.
And
makes sense.
I mean, he's a great chef. That goes without saying. But mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. He had a real tight timeline, and he had it all written down, which is great.
Cool. I can tell you a bit about the food that we made, like the menus that he wrote. So that Wednesday reception, it was almost 300 people in earnest, and they actually opened up some of the kitchens. So people, they would have like service stations in the kitchens,
right?
Because we can't fit 300 people in earnest.
Right. Although there is a chef's table in the kitchen and stuff, right? So,
yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So in that area, kind of where the chef's table is, they set up more seating in there. Or?
There was no seating. There was just, it was all a standing reception. Like the service hallway that separates the kitchens from the dining room, that was all open. And there was like food laid out on some of the counters there. And then one of the lab that's adjacent to the one that I work in was fully opened, and they had a big charcuterie board, and they were slicing meats with the, they have an old, one of those hand cranked Italian meat slicers. So my class, Blair wrote a menu for us. It's kind of like, sort of like past hors d'oeuvres or kind of like little action stations that people could come and pick little plates up from. And so we made six things. They were, first of all, roasted pig's head pulled pork sandwich.
Okay.
So picture like a little, like a lobster roll, like a buttery roll that's cut,
vertically.
And mm-hmm. then the pulled meat and some of the, crispy crackling and stuff chopped up from a pig's head put in there, and then finished with, it was like an apple and, Savoy cabbage slaw. And also a rhubarb spritz. And this was,
oh, cool.
I read this menu and I was like, oh, okay, they're serving a spritz. Like I was thinking like an Aperol
right,
spritz.
Like it's a beverage.
Like it's a pairing. And so at one point, sense. Just a few days before the chef and res started, I emailed the front of house manager and was like, are you making the spritz or shall I, or like, my students making the spritz or did you order the gin or whatever? and they're like, we're pretty sure that it's part of the food. And then I looked through and was like, oh yeah, that's right. So what we would build these little sandwiches, and then we had a mixture of, it was rhubarb gin and, Fee Brothers rhubarb bitters. And they spritzed the sandwich with this mixture.
Just like a little atomizer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's funny.
And so that's why we had the extra pig head shale, is because we brought in six whole pig heads, cooked them all, took all the meat and crackling off of five of them. And then we reserved the sixth one because we wanted to have it on display during service. So it was out on the station during service. And then, it came
back.
Was
that at Blair's request or was that just?
Yes. At Blair's request.
A part of
them. And then the pig head went back into the fridge, and then the students decided they would turn it into sisig.
Cool.
Yeah.
Can we just circle back to the sisig for a second?
Sure. Yeah.
How was it?
Oh, it was awesome. Like the one that the students made?
Yeah.
It was great.
And it was very different from the one at Seafood City? Or?
Yeah. It wasn't really, it didn't have a sauce. Like it was seasoned with like soy, garlic, chili, it wasn't really saucy the way that the Seafood City one was.
Right. So it's more like a, like a chopped up loose meat kind of
exactly.
Like pulled meat kind of thing.
Yeah. But it was good, good textures. There's bits of crunchy ear and some crackling, and then yeah, just the nice meat from the head. And it was really strongly flavored with red onion, and they had red bell pepper in there as well.
Cool.
Yeah, it was tasty.
Okay. So this reception, this was during the evening?
Yes. Yeah.
And it was just, and the patrons were people from the Edmonton food scene. So what, restaurateurs and food writers and...
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, the, well, I'm not going to name drop, I guess, but yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay.
Restaurant owners, writers, just, yeah. And just friends of the program. It was nice. It was a good vibe because it was, it being an Edmonton chef, it was like,
yeah,
it was like a reunion kind of. It wasn't,
yeah, I was going to say it must've been a lot of people there that, you know, a lot of familiar faces. Mm-hmm.
It was fun actually. Yeah. It was, I'm always nervous when they say they want to open up the kitchens, and just like,
right.
That's sometimes that is a bit dicey, but as soon as, so I was a little bit nervous about it, at the start of the evening, but by the time you, yeah, like you said, you see so many familiar faces, and it's really fun to, it was almost like the chefs who were attending the event, like wanted to hang out in the kitchen more than they did in the
front. Of course.
So there was
really
some nice little moments where like the tricky thing about the week was we have this huge event on Wednesday and a huge event on Thursday. So we're like trying to do their production for Thursday while this Wednesday event is happening. And so in the back there's chefs, you know, like what, cleaning 60 kilos of bison flat iron for the next day. And a nice little moment where, you know, for instance, Jared, who I don't know if he's the chef de cuisine or a sous chef, but he has worked at Range Road for years and years.
Okay.
This nice little moment where he decides that he's going to clean up bison flat iron for us. And even though he's a guest, even though he's a guest at the event, he started to clean bison for us. But
that's pretty sweet.
Yeah, it was fun.
And do you want to run down the menu?
Yeah.
So you had the pig's head sandwich.
Yeah. Pig's head pulled pork. There was an elk shake, pannekoek.
Oh.
So like a little, soft, kind of like a thick crepe, with braised veal shank, fromage blanc from Lakeside Farm, Parisienne pears, roasted squash, and pickled Fresno chilies. And so you could pick these up and kind of eat them like a little taco almost.
Like a little taco kind of, yeah.
There was...
That sounds delicious.
Cedar paper wrapped walleye with BC spot prawns and a shrimp velouté. So
wow.
This was... I had never seen this product before, but cedar paper, like it's... Mm-hmm. I don't even know how it's produced, but it's like you can cook en papillote, but it's with a piece of pliable cedar instead of parchment.
Right. And yeah, so, I think it's like I don't exactly know how it's produced either, but I think it's just planed from like flat pieces of cedar.
But it's remarkable how, like if you, when it's soaked,
like
it's
freshly still, though.
Yeah.
Like it's not a like old dried log. It's like fresh trees, I think.
Right.
Yeah. And then, but you have to rehydrate it, right? Before you wrap with it?
Yes. Or, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And yeah, so the idea obviously that it's kind of adding some of that aroma to the fish. Mm-hmm. And yeah, those were, they were kind of all rolled and tied. And then for service, the little bit of pageantry was that the chef would take the twine off and open up the paper roll and then cut chunks off of it for people to try. So
cool. So it was like a whole fish that was wrapped like that, and then
pieces. Like we received the walleye as skinless fillets, then just cleaned them into the I don't think this was Blair's original conception, but the cedar paper that we brought in was only, I would say, 5 or 6 inches square. And so we would just cut 3 ounce pieces from the walleye kind of loin, the medius part of the fillet. And then each of these 3 ounce pieces would be rolled sorry, like sauced and have shrimp added, or sorry, the spot prawns added and then rolled individually. And so the 3 ounces of walleye, that was for this evening, like it was just, we would cut that into whatever 1 ounce pieces for people. But then later on for our 4-course menu Thursday and Friday evening, that was a portion. Like we would just put the 3 ounce wrapped piece on a plate.
Gotcha. Would you put it on the plate still wrapped?
Well, that was something that was the original idea, was that it would just be put. I think the original idea was it would be a much larger piece of cedar paper with a much larger piece of fish in it.
Right.
And then for every 2 guests or something, you would put one large packet on the table and they could open it up.
Right. Kind of a family style thing.
Yeah, totally. But then since the paper that we got in was smaller, and because when we put it on a plate, we're like, well, that doesn't look too interesting. We did end up, we would still serve it in the paper, but we untied the twine and we opened up the paper. So you could still get the smell of the, cedar and see how it was cooked. Yeah. But yeah, it looked a little, there was more, a more interesting presentation. And we also put some, wilted black kale and stuff on the plate, but, and some of the velouté, but.
Okay.
What else? There was a grilled lamb sirloin that had a black garlic and hemp seed glaze and was served with wilted spinach and a bacon vinaigrette.
Yum.
It was really delicious. The student nailed the cook on the lamb, and so they just had like a little carving station, and then they would slice it, glaze it, put on a little bed of spinach. Really tasty. There was a duck rillette served on baguette with some little pickled mushrooms and pickled carrots. And there was a green bean terrine, which is fun to say.
Oh,
it was, we brought in a special, kind of ham. It was called Prager ham. So we lined the terrine. It's like a smoked and dry cured ham. So similar to prosciutto, and lined the terrine with those, put, lines of blanched green beans, and then filled it with mixed them with chopped kimchi, then made aspic and filled the mold. And it sounds odd, like I don't know, but the flavors make sense, and it was really really delicious. Like
it's the kind of thing that I'm sure takes careful preparation, because it could go horribly wrong, I feel like.
Yes, totally, yeah.
But it sounds very different and amazing. I'm sure, if prepared correctly, it's delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So those were the 6 items that we produced for the Wednesday reception.
Cool.
For the Thursday and Friday dinners, it was a 4-course menu. So one of those was dessert. So we were producing 3 savory dishes. Mm-hmm. The first of which was the cedar wrapped walleye. And then there was a pork belly with smoked mussels, apple compote, and a maple beurre blanc.
Mm.
And then the principal plate, I believe actually on the menu at Rangewood right now, and one of their best known dishes. It's grilled bison flat iron with hazelnut spätzle, black currants, and sunflower shoots.
Wow, that sounds great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
hazelnut spätzle. Is it like, how hazelnut is it? Is it just barely holding together with flour, or?
No, it's more like roasted and ground hazelnuts added to the batter.
Okay.
I didn't actually taste it because I think because I'm allergic to hazelnuts. Remember?
Oh, right.
Remember?
You're allergic to hazelnuts. Oh, so you weren't allowed to prepare any food in the kitchen for the whole week?
No, I'm not that sensitive, but I didn't. And it could, we've talked about this before, but it could be that I could have eaten it and been fine, but I just don't, I'm not a,
yeah,
don't want to take the risk. So, and I can't remember, what the actual proportion was, but you could see the toasted nuts like speckled through the spätzle.
Speckled spätzle.
Say that 10 times fast. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. And dessert, you didn't have to worry about, I assume, again.
Correct. It was some kind of creme brulee. I should know. I don't remember what. It involved pear.
Okay.
That's all I got. But it was a creme brulee.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds amazing. So it was a lot. What do you want to talk about next? I kind of know what I want to talk about next, but I want to...
No, yeah, go for it. What do you got?
Alan, tell me about procurement.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds boring, right? I'm just like, that for me is the thing where I'm like, okay, there's a lot of stuff on here that doesn't sound easily procured.
Right.
And also, it's different procuring something for like a week than it is procuring it like on an ongoing basis. If you're
right.
If you're buying something on an ongoing basis, you can secure a supply of that thing, mm-hmm. right? But getting something for a week, especially in my experience in Edmonton, like the supply of everything that's available is usually taken up because no one wants to take a risk on holding yes. any product. No supplier in Edmonton wants to have any product on hand in their warehouse that they don't already have a customer for. Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. And the only time that you can get something that isn't normally available is when something falls through and the customer that would normally take it isn't able to.
Right.
And then, you know, then the supplier is desperately trying to get you to take it for something. Mm-hmm. Just do something with it.
Right. Yeah. Well,
so yeah, I'm really curious to find out how that went.
It was so obviously, like, even though when I requisition product for that lab, like I'm sending a requisition to an entire procurement team at Nate. So right. I did place orders for these products, but it was the procurement team, weeks in advance, had to go out and find vendors for a lot of these specialty items. Mm-hmm. And it's a huge amount of work for them, and it had to be done well in advance. So even something like
right.
the flat iron is a common cut, I guess. Like, it's easy to get beef flat iron. It's not as easy to get, bison flat iron isn't as common, but with right. sufficient notice, it's easy for the producers to supply it. And so I'm sure three or four weeks before the event, procurement was reaching out. Like, most of them have culinary backgrounds, and so they could either read mm-hmm. the recipes and understand how to scale them and how much product would be needed given the amount of people that we expected. And if they were unsure, they would just ask right. the chefs who would be preparing it. And so, yeah, like with sufficient notice, it's easy to procure 60 kilograms of bison flat irons.
Yeah. What about the spot prawns?
Okay. So
I know we've talked about it on the show before.
That's exactly right. So they,
yeah.
When it came time for me to do the requisitions, the procurement lead said, we've got spot prawns in the system, BC frozen spot prawns, just order as you normally would. And I told her, like, we actually tried to put spot prawns on a menu before and the quality was inferior. And so would it be possible to get a sample of the, prawns that we would be bringing in? And so the week before chef in residence, we got a couple pounds of spot prawns. They were definitely not the same thing that I had tried a couple years ago. Cause those were, if I remember right, like, they were from Alaska and they mm-hmm. were just so mushy and discolored and right. really, really poor. But these ones were,
they were frozen in block, right? I think
those ones were,
if
yeah,
I remember.
These ones that they got in, so it was from Seven Seas, like a local distributor, uh-huh. and they were whole spot prawns head on, just frozen whole.
Wow.
And a much...
Like IQF.
Yeah, they were kind of like, they were still in, they were kind of frozen together, but not in an ice block. So like you could pick up
a
dozen at a time, kind of. Quite good quality. The meat tasted wonderful. And it was flaky and firm. It had a little bit of a slightly mushy finish, like a little bit of a mm-hmm. kind of mealy finish. But for the application that we were using them, because it was going to be eaten with the walleye and going to be sauced with the velouté, it wasn't right. an issue in the final product, but, And they were from BC. They were just labeled BC spot prawns. It was pretty good product, actually. Yeah.
Oh, so now the wheels are turning.
Well, maybe, yeah. And some of the specialty items were easily procured, like say black currants. Like those are always available from Mona Foods right. locally.
What about the cedar paper?
The cedar paper, Blair had a guy. He gave us the contact. Just give me 1 second, actually. I don't know if this is important. I have the name of the supplier. It's just interesting because it's a really interesting product and one that I hadn't seen before. And even like one of the people who was attending Wednesday night, Scott Iserhoff, who's a local indigenous chef, used to have a spot called Pipischu. And he was kind of floored by that. He's like, I'm indigenous and I've never even seen this before. So he was really interested in it.
Cool.
So the supplier is called BC Coastal Grilling Planks. It's in Parksville, British Columbia. And so we ordered a few hundred, little sheets of cedar paper.
Cool.
What would it?
If that's where Blair normally orders it from, and he was surprised that he was expecting larger pieces. Is that because the wrong size just got ordered, or they just didn't have the size that he normally uses?
I have no idea. I don't know if it was a miscommunication or not.
And then the other thing was that I was kind of curious about is like, I guess like you've sort of answered this already, but like, I guess like, you know, was there a lot of sort of communication between the procurement team and Blair in terms of finding some of these specialty products? So like with the cedar paper, you know, Blair provided them with someone who could supply it. Was that the case also for any of the other ingredients? Or because I imagine if like, you know, if it's a riff on a dish that they have on the menu at Range Road, that they have a supplier that they normally order most of the components, you know, the ingredients for the components from. Mm-hmm. And so, you know,
I don't 100% know. I would suspect though that many of the many of the people who supply Range Road might have had difficulty supplying on the scale that we needed for this event. So for instance, like I ordered 100 pounds of walleye. So I don't
right.
and that came from fisheries in Manitoba. And I don't know if that's a source that Range Road would typically use.
Gotcha.
So like a lot of the smaller farms that they use, like say Nature's Green Acres for pork, and I think Brook Farms for beef, I suspect that they don't have 60 kilos of flat iron lying around or
that
kind of thing. So I don't know if there is any other specific examples. Certainly like that Lakeside cheese that I mentioned, that's something that they do use at Range Road that he suggested we bring in, which we were able to do.
Oh, cool.
There were also a few things we weren't able to get, and so we just had to tweak the menu. Like I think that elk shank that I mentioned was originally supposed to be venison shank, but we couldn't procure it in time. I think he had some dishes, not for anything that I was involved with, but some dishes where he wanted to use rabbit kidney wasn't available, so they found a substitution. But the procurement side, different chefs and residents will have different requirements, because some of them that we've had, the style is much more kind of like French international, and so it wasn't as difficult to procure the ingredients for them. But folks like certainly Blair Lebsack, certainly Jeremy Charles, that would have been, I wasn't actually present for that one, but that would have been a very interesting one for procurement because it focused so much on seafood. And I think in that case, I've heard stories that Jeremy Charles, he literally brought the food with him. Like had, you know, bay scallops shipped out and stuff like that. So,
Can you remind me, I don't know if I'm familiar with who Jeremy Charles is.
He's best known because he was the chef and co-owner of a restaurant in St. John's, Newfoundland called Raymond's, which was heavily publicized. Like it was in like the New York Times and considered one of the best restaurants in Canada. He has a book called Wildness that we've actually talked about a little bit in our discussion of Canadian cuisine. But a very, like his style, if you can picture someone who's doing new Nordic in Newfoundland, that's like the pictures, the photography and the sensibilities in, from Raymond's, which unfortunately closed during the pandemic and never reopened. It was very, very much the same ilk as New Nordic, like lots of foraged ingredients, cool. lots of seafood, yeah. lots of wild game.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of the thing. Like, I know, and that's sort of what I was wondering about with Blair, too. Like, how much of this stuff did, you know, he feel like he had to bring from his own supply or something like mm-hmm. that? Like, thinking that he may not be able to get the quality of what, you know, of the ingredient that he wanted or something. I know, like, I know, for instance, that Noma, when they do pop-ups in other places, like, they've done pop-ups in Mexico and in Japan. Mm. In a lot of those cases, they are shipping agricultural products that they need to get licenses for, that they bring from Denmark, which is like the only place where they can get the ones that they want. And they mm-hmm. They set up a supply so that they can have them during the time that they're there. And they just, they bring their own product with them
right.
in a lot of cases. I mean, in a lot of cases, they also want to work with product that's available in the place that they're doing the pop-up, and the menus right. are planned that way mm-hmm. For things that they can forage in Japan or in Mexico. And, you know, and they work with chefs there, and, you know, they have friends there, and that's why they're going there. And so right. they're aware of the products that they can get, but mm-hmm. they also, there's, I think in a lot of cases, things that they want to bring that they just have to bring their own or whatever.
There were definitely,
and I've heard that about a lot of like chefs at like some of those food conferences too, when they want to do their dinner, they have to bring, you know, like if you want the caviar that you serve in your restaurant, you have to bring it with you.
Right.
Like there's no way somebody can procure it because you're the only one who can mm-hmm. in a lot of cases. So
there definitely were a handful of, products that, were purchased, like Nate purchased from the butchery by Range Road. I actually don't know what the lunch menu was, but for that special Thursday lunch, I think they were serving dry aged strip loin.
Okay.
And so that they just bought from the butchery because they have their own dry aging program and it's not,
gotcha.
not easy to procure.
So, yeah. Sorry, did you say they had a lunch and a dinner?
Yeah, that's right. So there was, a lunch, like a Blair Lebsack lunch on Thursday.
Okay.
And then there was a different Blair Lebsack menu Thursday night and Friday night.
So Thursday there was a lunch, and then there was a 4-course dinner on Thursday night and then Friday night, but yeah. no lunch on Friday.
Yeah, I don't know why they do it this
I'm wondering,
way,
the reason why I'm asking so specifically is because a friend of mine, Jason, who also listens to the show, messaged me last week and asked and said that he was going to Ernest's for lunch. Mm. And I can't remember which day it was on, unfortunately. I don't want to check my phone right now, but he like, because he listens to the show, he's aware that, you know, you do the evening dining program, and he asked me if you also have anything to do with the lunch there. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, no, I think he only handles dinner.
Yeah.
But if he went on Thursday, then he would have had the Blair menu.
That's so. Right. I think, and then on Friday, because most Fridays for lunch, they have a buffet service. And I think,
right. okay.
I don't know if. Like it wasn't a Blair Lebsack menu. It might have had some dishes and preparations that were either inspired by it or something, but it was
using up ingredients that you guys had made for the reception or
yeah,
something.
Yeah,
or,
totally.
Yeah.
And in terms of the, I don't think there was anything else that was too challenging, like with enough notice. I mean, there was lots of what we would call special orders, like that usually require a week's lead time, like black garlic mm-hmm. and certain brands of whiskey right. that wanted to be used and stuff like that. But
you didn't go to Seafood City for the walleye? I'm shocked, Alan.
Well, they had walleye or pickerel there, right? Is that one of the things that we talked about?
Yeah, I think
about?
So.
Yeah. But do they have 100 pounds of it? That's the real question.
Yeah, mm-hmm. maybe. I don't know. They have a lot of seafood there. Mm-hmm. Cool. And was there anything ingredient wise or product wise that Blair wasn't happy with, or was it all pretty smooth?
No, there was no, like, because we had enough time, and where there were any issues or any concerns that the quality wouldn't be there, like the spot prawns, then we were able to get samples. Yeah. And so, no, not that I know of. I think he was quite happy.
That's great. Yeah. Cool. So it was a lot.
Yeah. Because it was, high volume, like the upper threshold of what we can do, really, like just in terms of space, yeah. like to do 300 Wednesday, 100 Thursday, 100 Friday. And then, yeah, like to the logistics involved in serving one menu this week and then a completely different menu the next. It's a lot of work, but it's, we've got lots of hands and support. So like between, you know, I have 10 students in this class, last week and lots of, staff that are willing to pitch in. So yeah, we got lots of assistance.
Cool. Yeah. It's funny because like, I know you've been busy mainly because I haven't spoken to you really in 3 weeks or mm-hmm. something, which is really odd, because we normally record the episode like the week before we're going to release it. But then sometimes we like compress it a little bit. If we know one of us is going to be away, we'll like record a couple in a row. And then sometimes something happens where, you know, we have to push recording an episode. And yeah, then it feels like we haven't spoken in like a month. And that's pretty much what it's like. Yeah.
We haven't talked in person since.
Like when earlier when you said that the last episode that we released was Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, I was like, Alan, that's impossible. And I almost corrected you.
Right.
Then I was like, no, wait, he's right.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
That's crazy. It seems like so long ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I know that you've been busy. What was it like for the students? Like, did they feel like did they have to put in extra work? Did they feel like they got crushed by it? Were they really excited? Were they happy? Like, how did that go?
The students in evening dining, they have a different schedule that week. The actual assigned class time that they have is the same number of hours, but they have some long days. And so for instance, this year we canceled their class on Monday because we knew they were going to have such a long day the following day. The really difficult thing is that we want everybody to be at that keynote address, which is at 9 in the morning on Tuesday, but also the evening dining students need to do production on Tuesday night. So they have a long day on Tuesday. Right. They're, you know, like a 12 or 13 hour day, sorry, a 12 hour day, with breaks, obviously, like they're not working that whole time. Mm-hmm. But then the other, to do those services Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, they just need to start a little bit earlier. Like I think on Wednesday they started at 2 p.m. instead of 4 p.m.
Right.
But they do end up spending the same number of hours like cooking in the lab over the course of the week, more or less. So.
And are they excited that they get to do different food, or are they just like, because they probably have 1 week of doing the regular menu or 2 weeks of doing the regular dinner menu there, and then they have to switch to a different menu, mm-hmm. and then they probably have to switch back if it's in the middle of their term. Although I guess this came at the end of a term
for the end of this block here. Generally they're excited. It's kind of like, it's the same two sides of the coin thing we were talking about earlier. It's like the evening dining students, they put in a lot of work during chef in residence week, but they get way more time and access,
exposure to Blair, to like the chef in residence.
Blair was in the class all of Tuesday night and then all of Wednesday, Thursday and Friday he had to go out into the dining room and say hi to people and all that. But like he was, you know, scheduled to be with the class all those evenings. So, they definitely got to hang out with him and talk to him a lot more than most other students did. And actually generally they were excited and interested in it because what we did for this group was, where the students would usually be, they would have a project where they have to make either a menu feature or a table d'hote menu, do the planning, procurement, prep and service of that. But, mm-hmm. Because our timeline was, so tight this block, we actually assigned each of them one of Blair's dishes. At the start of the term, at the start of the block, they got the menu and they each were copy given the recipes associated with a certain dish. And so they had to take ownership of it. And I think that will be really memorable memorable for them. Cause if you are just doing production and you get these recipes thrown at you and you don't really see the bigger picture, like I don't remember anything that was produced. I don't remember a single dish from the chefs in residence when I was a student, but I hope that these students will at the very least remember these dishes that they were involved in the planning of and service of. because most of them are able to, like, they were for the students who were doing items from the Wednesday reception, like, they were in the dining room serving the food that they had prepared. So
yeah,
hopefully that is memorable for them.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay. Anything else you want to mention about the Chef in Residence program?
It's really fun. It's like it's good energy. It's a lot of work, but, like, you know, to see, to fill the auditorium with culinary students who are all in their full whites and everything, it's, there's just like a nice energy to it. It's fun.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm really interested in it. I think, like, maybe it's too bad that I think that if I had known a little bit further ahead that this was happening and that Blair was going to be the chef in residence, and I would have tried to make plans to try to get to come to one of the dinners or something like that. Mm-hmm. It seems really interesting. And, like, especially the reception, I don't know if there's a way for me to get into the reception next year, but, like, you know, having a whole bunch of, like, you know, Edmonton chefs and stuff, and, like, you know, in that kind of environment where people can mingle and talk about food in Edmonton, it, you know, mm-hmm. sounds like it's right up my alley. Yeah. I'd like to be involved in it.
Okay. I'll see what I can do.
And then, so next week it's just back to the regular menu. Hey.
Yeah. Starting tomorrow.
Okay.
Well, sorry. New group of students today. So we'll do orientation and we'll try and, like, we're on the prep side. We're basically starting with nothing.
Starting from scratch.
Like, we did some things we were able to start on Friday of last week once we knew service was taken care of, baked some bread and stuff, but
that's good, because I still want to come in for dinner, so
okay,
still want to try the dry edge duck.
Oh yeah, that was like on Friday we hung a bunch of ducks and stuff like that, so
oh good.
And more coming today.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.